welcome to another episode of the Rational Face Podcast. I am Brian Dillman, and today I am riding Lone Ranger, hosting the podcast all by myself. I'll be able to make it through. What we have for you today is another installment of the top 10 books in Mormon history. In today's episode, I discuss with Ben Park the book Massacre at Mountain Meadows. And rather than try and describe what this book is and how I felt about it here in the prelude, I'll jump right to the interview. But please hang on to the end, as I have a few words that I think are worth considering when thinking about the massacre at Mountain Meadows. Well, I am back once again with Ben Park to talk about the third book in our top 10 list. And this book discusses an episode in Mormon history that I think we all collectively wish never happened. And I think it would be easy to argue that this is the blackest spot on Mormon history, and it's hard to deal with. And the book that we're talking about is Massacre at Mountain Meadows, that was published in 2008, written by three historians, Ron Walker, Richard Turley, and Glenn Leonard. This hasn't had nearly as much attention as polygamy. There's a lot of books written about polygamy, mostly because there's a lot of documentation and there's a lot of opinions on it. This is one event, the Mountain Meadows Massacre, and we're going to do our best to talk about it in a respectful way and to discuss why this is an important work on this subject. So to get started, Ben, Mountain Meadows Massacre is always a controversial topic in Mormon history. Let's talk about, real briefly, how it has been discussed in Mormon dialogue.
Sure. First of all, happy to be on here again with you, Brian. I think it's important to note that the way that Mormons have dealt with Mountain Meadows Massacre has been quite crucial to our own sense of historical identity and pretty at the center of the changes of how we approach the past, because a long time we presented the massacre in these terms of these good guys, bad guys type of narrative that was crucial to Mormon historical discourse for its first 100 years. We usually talked about, or when we would mention the massacre, if we mentioned it at all, we would say it was something that was perpetuated by the Native Americans, or if white Mormons were involved, they were involved because these immigrants were bad guys who were doing things like claiming that they were part of the mob who killed Parley Pratt in Arkansas, or that they were Missourians who were part of the group that kicked the Mormons out, or that they're going around and destroying property and poisoning cows, and therefore the Mormons were justified in taking action, that it's almost a defensive measure that they did, which of course is absolute hogwash, but was part of this narrative of how we presented it itself. Me personally, I'd never heard about the massacre until I was on my mission, and I had one person who was investigating the church bring up the issue to me, and I was kind of bewildered. I'm like, what the heck is this? And so I had to go research as much as I can, which is hard to do with when you're a missionary with limited resources, but it really shocked me, because this is one of those things that can quite be shocking when you come to, because you think, not only is this a horrible event, but why haven't I been told about this?
Yeah, I had a similar experience. The first time that I had heard about this event was when I watched the PBS documentary, The Mormons, just a couple of years ago, right around the time that this book was published. It was produced in 2006, the documentary. And I was sitting there, newly married, on the couch watching this, watching the Gentiles, the media, portray Mormonism, and then they talked about Mountain Meadows Massacre in a pretty straightforward way, and it just made me sick to my stomach. Mm. And, you know, didn't really know how to deal with it, and there wasn't any way out, you know. There weren't these narratives in the way the Mormons documentary was presented. it was just straightforward and right there. And so, yeah, I agree that it's something that doesn't get talked about very much, and it's just uncomfortable because it's just awful.
Right. So there are a few the real pioneer who helped us see the massacre for what it was Juanita Brooks. She was doing her historical work in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s. She had earned a master's degree in history from Columbia. She taught English. She had historical tools at her disposal. She had served on the board of the Utah Historical Society, and she was well researched in the diaries and founding documents of territorial Utah, which made her well prepared to write the book The Mountain Meadows Massacre, which was published by University of Oklahoma in 1950. It was the first modern scholarly account of the event that was based in resources and really took an unflinching look at what happened. She blamed the Mormons for the massacre. This wasn't it was not provoked by the immigrants, and it was B, not something led by the Native Americans. It argued that Brigham Young was a, quote, accessory after the fact, meaning that he did not directly order it, but the culture in which he imbibed and the rhetoric that he used set up an environment in which that thing could happen, and that the Mormons in the end presented John D. Lee as a scapegoat to be the one guilty to cover the sins of many. Her work was not approved of by church leadership because this might be surprising to say, but saying that Brigham Young was an accessory after the fact to one of the most gruesome events in American history is probably not going to win over church leaders in the 1950s, unfortunately. And so while she was never disciplined, she felt ostracized because she had the courage to speak up about this historical event. While Brooks' count is problematic in some regards and is based on sources that or is lacking the sources that are available now, and just in general, any book published 60 years ago is going to be dated and not as useful today, it's quite amazing how relevant the book still is and how much her conclusions hold up. And it's still a remarkable read and a must read for anyone interested in the topic. And it actually still remained the definitive account of the event until Will Bagley came along 50 years later.
Yeah, it seems that there's really, as far as academic-y historical books discussing this, there's three. There's Mountain Meadows Massacre, Blood of the Prophets, and then the massacre at Mountain Meadows that we're going to discuss today.
Right. So Will Bagley comes along and writes the book The Blood of the Prophets, Brigham Young, and the Massacre at Mountain Meadows. Will Bagley has been a very prolific and active and acclaimed historian, even though he just has a bachelor's in history. He's been a professional historian for a few decades and has produced a number of very important work. He's the editor of a phenomenal series called Kingdom in the West, The Mormons of the American Frontier, that has, I think, 14, 13, 15 volumes, something along there, that are very crucial for historians of Utah. But he writes Blood of the Prophets, Brigham Young, and the Massacre at Mountain Meadows. And besides giving a much more detailed account of the event and drawing from sources that hadn't really been utilized before and actually doing a lot of groundwork that historians had overlooked, the central part of his argument, as seen by the subtitle of the book, is that Brigham Young had a dominant role or a central role in the massacre, specifically that Brigham Young ordered the massacre. Now, the book received a lot of praise. It received the Spur Award from the Western Writers of America, as well as a couple book awards from the Western Historical Association. To many non-Mormon academics, it confirmed what they were hoping to hear about Brigham Young being at the center of the controversy. And while a lot of his argument is very effective, and if you're interested in the Mountain Meadows Massacre, you simply have to read the book. There's still a lot of things that are to be that are contested. At the center of his argument is the involvement of a couple of Native Americans, especially a meeting that's held on September 1st of 1857, recorded in Dimmock Huntington's journal, where they're discussing incoming immigrants and the relationship with the Americans and the ownership of land and the giving spoils to the natives. And there's disputes over the wordings of things. There's one entry in the journal has an Indian reporting that they're afraid to fight the Americans and so would raise grain, whereas Will Bagley read that document to say afraid to fight the Americans and so would raise allies, and he uses that as evidence for this argument that Brigham Young is giving, is making an agreement with these natives at September 1. He also argues that Brigham Young instructs a Santa Clara Paiute leader, I'm going to butcher this name, Tutsagavitis, I'm going to call him Tuts, who had traveled to Salt Lake City with Jacob Hamblin and George A. Smith, and that Brigham Young gave him the command to go back to Mount Meadows to massacre the immigrants. The problem is that it's very hard to keep this figure or see this figure going down to southern Utah after this, because there's contemporary sources that shows that he stays with Jacob Hamblin's party in Salt Lake City until September 16th, including that he was ordained as an elder on September 12th. Bagley tries to get around this by saying that this guy whose name I can't pronounce, rushed back to southern Utah, then rushes back in time. And so there's timeline issues. But in general, it's still a massive and immense work that needs to be acknowledged and read for historians. And importantly, it set the stage for the Massacre at Mountain Meadows book to eventually be written.
Since Blood of the Prophets and what's stated in the preface of Massacre at Mountain Meadows, there is some more source material that has been dug up since then.
Right.
The authors talk about the, I don't know if they're called the Jensen Papers, but Andrew Jensen had gone in the 1890s. Is that right?
That's correct. They're one of the immense archival resources that was not engaged before because it was not available was that Andrew Jensen was sent down to southern Utah. Andrew Jensen was the assistant church historian in the late 19th century and early 20th century. He was sent down to southern Utah in the 1890s to interview people who had been involved in the massacre at Mount Meadows. And these interviews are both very important as well as very problematic because, A, they're reminiscences, they're taking place several decades after the event takes place, and B, I mean, how much information are you going to get from people when they're talking about a grisly murder of innocent men, women, and children? And so there, you have to be careful with these, and the way that Walker, Turley, and Leonard deal with it, they say that we quickly learn that these people often don't tell the truth about themselves, but they're also mention things that are corroborated by other sources concerning other people. So they're very tricky documents, but I actually think they're used quite effectively in this book, and they're actually published on their own in a volume edited by these same authors by BYU Studies.
So just a quick quote from that preface regarding the Andrew Jensen source material. He says that he did not enjoy his experience of doing these interviews, which he was sent to do. He says, "I have been successful in getting the desired information for the first presidency," he wrote in his diary, "but it has been unpleasant business. The information I received made me suffer mentally and deprived me of my sleep at nights, and I felt tired and fatigued both mentally and physically when I returned home." And the authors of Mountain Meadow, Massacre at Mountain Meadows go on to say, it was a reaction that we as authors have come to appreciate.
Oh, I imagine.
Yeah. So let's talk about this book. The massacre is something that, as I said in the beginning, a lot of people would rather forget. So what was the impetus behind the church really commissioning this work to be done?
Well, there was several different streams that led into it that became the impetus. First of all, there had been a big movement within the church historical department in Salt Lake saying we need to be able to come to rectify what happened in Massacre at Mountain Meadows. There only through admitting what happened and giving a unflinching and truthful account can we have true catharsis and kind of rid ourselves of the ghost of Mountain Meadows. And secondly, and the authors have actually admitted this sometimes, is, you know, Bagley's book proved an impetus for them, that they felt they needed to offer an account in response to Bagley's take, especially since Bagley's book received such a rave and important reviews. They felt there needed to be a response, and they felt that the church needed to have a truthful account for its own healing and progressive movement. And so in 2001, through a series of negotiations, the task fell on Ronald Walker, Glenn Leonard, and Rick Turley. All three were known entities in the Mormon history community. Turley had been a director of the historical department of the church for a while. Glenn Leonard had directed the church history museum for over a decade. And Ron Walker had been a BYU professor for a while and had written several really important works on Mormon history. And so they were going to tag team and come together and write this book that ended up taking a lot longer than they expected. I think I remember them saying once that they expected it to be a couple years project and be done with it quite quickly. And that quick project quickly turned into a six, seven, 8 year long project that had an army of researchers. I exaggerate with an army of researchers, but they had several people who were working full or part time, helping research, helping edit, helping track down sources, which for one thing is a very privileged position to be in. This is not the type of book that could be produced by a single author, which should be acknowledged because they had a lot of money at their disposal to be able to have all these people help them. And they had lots of very bright minds helping them, including people like Barbara Jones Brown, Janice Johnson, a handful of others who really did a lot of the legwork and the behind the scenes muscle that made the book what it is. And over these years, the book took many different formats. Should it be a long historiographical centered work? Should it be more of a narrative driven work? Should it be an 800 page tome? Should it be a 400 page exhaustive work? They eventually came down and just on the side of it should be a shorter narrative driven, very readable, very accessible book, which has a lot of positives. Namely, it's very readable. People who are not very interested in academic history can jump in and read 220 pages without much of a problem. The downsides of that is in choosing to not engage with historiographical sources because they felt that that would bog things down. It's kind of hard at times to see where their novel approach is. It's kind of hard to see where they diverge from Will Bagley in some cases, and more especially with Juanita Brooks. So as a result of the approach it took, it's much more powerful in cultural, layman, common terms, while probably not as useful as it could have been for the scholarly community.
So they wrote it... they wrote it more for the church or for church members to be able to read and to be able to use use as a learning tool rather than, I mean, there's not a lot of academic books that are going to be read by everyday members.
Absolutely.
One other thing in the preface I thought I would read is that they talked about in 1990 there were dedication ceremonies at the memorials that are in place in southern Utah for the victims. And Rex E. Lee, who was a descendant of one of the most prominent participants in the massacre, in a gesture of forgiveness and reconciliation at a speech at one of these ceremonies, said, "Not only tragedy and grief, but also human dignity, mutual understanding, and a willingness to look forward and not back," is the way he framed the way we should look at this historical event. But in sort of in response to that, one of the descendants of the survivors said this: "While great strides have been made in recent years, until the church shows more candor about what its historians actually know about the event, true reconciliation will be elusive." And the authors say, "Only complete and honest evaluation of the tragedy can bring the trust necessary for lasting goodwill. Only then can there be catharsis." And I think you pointed to that. But this is really targeted at the church members to be able to use to process this aspect of history.
Absolutely. In a very important way, it's a very parochial book in that sense, that it's meant for a particular audience that a lot of academic books don't seek to engage. And there are, as I mentioned, benefits and pitfalls that come with that.
Okay. I would like to give kind of an overview of what the book is like, but it's got the preface that kind of gives you the idea of why they wrote it and what new things they were contributing. They talk about the Jensen papers. And then it gets into the story, and it actually starts much after the fact where they're cleaning up the bones, and it's quite grim cleaning up the massacre years later. And then it goes through the story of what happened. And in the end, the things that I wanted to point out, the appendix I find to be sort of a book memorial, because they have four parts. They've got the list of the immigrants, all the people that they are able to identify that were in the party that was massacred, a list of the immigrants' property, and then Appendix C has the militiamen that were involved that have been identified, and the Native Americans in Appendix D that were involved. And so it's somewhat of a it seemed like the right thing in my mind to give that space, sort of like a moment of silence, make an effort to recognize those that whose lives were taken in this event.
Sure, and it makes it a very helpful resource as well.
Yeah. So let's kind of go through how the book covers this event.
Sure. First of all, it should be noted that it's written in quite beautiful prose. It's much better written than you'd usually find a scholarly history book, which makes the reading quite enjoyable. But it's centered around what I'd see two main prisms. First, the question, why do otherwise good people commit atrocious acts? And that's a center question that frames much of the debate. Why do people who are by most accounts, good people do horrible things? And the book is trying to attempt how that happens. The book is one big response to that. On that note, one leading Western historian, John Farragher at Yale University, who's one of the biggest historians of American West, who mostly agreed with Massacre in Mountain Meadows and sees it as the definitive book on the massacre. He actually disagreed with this way of framing it because he says that's leading from a presumption that they are otherwise good men. And so they're that should be kept in mind in looking at this. And the second prism is a central theme that's driving throughout the book, is drawing from the theories of psychological and sociological studies of atrocities and violence. And by looking at the literature that cover how horrible things happen, there are several main elements that this literature describes, that those who commit atrocities demonize others, they succumb to strict obedience, or strict authority, sorry, they practice blind obedience, they're under peer pressure, there's ambiguity from of direction, there's great fear, and there's deprivation, whether it's starvation or poverty or what have you. And all of these elements, these authors tell us, were present in southern Utah. So in a way, while this event is isolated to southern Utah, it is, you can draw broader implications of connecting it to many other types of violent acts. And I think that's important in contextualizing what went on in Mount Meadows.
Now I'm trying to remember, did they talk much, did they spend much time here? I know in the church essay they did, but did they spend much time here talking about violence they experienced and participated in Missouri and Nauvoo?
Yeah, the first chapter in this book kind of is a general overview of Mormon history at this point, because you can't have a Mormon history book if you don't have one chapter that gives a history of Mormonism. But it frames it in a way that emphasizes they faced persecution in Missouri, they faced persecution in Illinois, and now they're facing persecution and violence in all these places, and now they're facing it in Utah, which kind of frames how they approach things. And so, of course, that historical background is tethered to a militant rhetoric that came with the Mormon Reformation of 1856, 1857, where the church leaders are causing a revival, stating everyone is too sinful, we need to do better. This is coupled with a millenarian outlook that the world is coming to an end. And this just leads to a very dire straits where Utah is basically dry kindling, waiting for a match to be struck. And that's what ends up happening in September of 1857.
Yeah, and when you mention the Mormon Reformation, this is where the doctrine of blood atonement was spread widely and with great fervor. We have a sense of anxiety from the sermons given during the Mormon Reformation. We have Buchanan's army, or at least news of Buchanan's army. And throughout the book, they try to point out that it appears that it was ambiguous where Buchanan's army was going to come from, whether it would have been coming from the south or from the north.
Or even from it was coming from the east, but they even feared it might be coming from the west, from California.
Yeah, and it's not hard to imagine in the isolation and the sense of paranoia going on. You can construct all sorts of crazy ideas and start to believe them. Whether they're logical or probable or not isn't as important when you're living in that kind of environment.
Right, and the authors do a lot to play up the fact that this is a part of the Utah War, that this is a part of, they play up the anecdote of Brigham Young celebrating what we now call Pioneer Day, July 24th, outside of Salt Lake City. They have all these festivities, and while they're there, they get news that James Buchanan, the president, is sending the army out to quell the Mormon rebellion. And Brigham Young starts thundering this rhetoric of, we're under attack again, now we're going to fight back. And this is the type of rhetoric that then spreads, because he sends George A. Smith to do a preaching mission down the south of Utah, who preaches fire and brimstone all along the way, and sets up this environment that is so crucial to understanding the actions that came next.
Right, and the environment that they created was hostile, very hostile towards these immigrants, mm-hmm. Who are on their way to Southern California, and there they have a hard time getting supplies as they travel through Utah and try to trade with the Mormons there. This is coming from the us versus them, the world is out to get us rhetoric that was preached during the Reformation. And really, this is at the peak of the Reformation.
Right. Well, yeah. Yeah, it's toward the end, but it's still in full force.
Yeah. Things have not calmed down in terms of the sermons. So let's talk a little bit about the immigrants. As you mentioned, historically, there's been a lot of stories that that talk about these false tales of the immigrants poisoning wells, knocking over fences, or you know, making these claims about killing Parley P. Pratt and what have you. And one of the other things that contribute to this that the authors tried to push was the environmental factors, that it was, if they had had rough winters, and I believe it was a drought, they were suffering a drought this summer, and that's why the cattle that this party was pushing through were having a harder time finding food, because the grass was not as tall as it normally was. And so they're just in a very tough, hostile situation. And I want to read two paragraphs on page 115 that I think, you know, we've kind of set this scene of what the environment was like. I think this section does a good job covering how we tell ourselves stories, or how we make up histories in order to make ourselves feel good or to justify our thoughts or actions.
Right.
So it reads, "People in every society build a memory or reconstruction of the past, the way in which past events are seen or interpreted by new generations. This tendency was certainly true with many of the Mormons and their view of the events leading to the Mountain Meadows Massacre. The terrible tragedy was hardly over before a version of events began to form that downplayed the settlers' wrongs and built up the immigrants. This retelling made the incidents at settlements along the southern route into an explanation that gave the atrocity a sense of grim inevitability. While some perpetrators of the massacre encouraged this interpretation by making false or misleading statements, for most Mormons the process was an attempt to make sense out of the unfathomable and to defend their society from assaults being made against it. The result was a version of history that smoothed Mormon guilt by suggesting that the immigrants somehow got what they deserved. An already troubled tale became still more confusing. There were conflicts on the southern road, but the immigrants did not deserve what eventually happened to them at Mountain Meadows. The massacre was not inevitable. No easy absolution for the perpetrators is possible. Their later posturing and rationalization could not overcome one irrefutable fact. All the purported wrongs of the immigrants, even if true, did not justify the killing of a single person." And I think that section needs to be, you know, in the ensign, or this is so crucial to me in understanding this, is that this is not designed to be a way around dealing with, this book is not designed to get around the Mountain Meadows Massacre and turn it into something that's not important. It absolutely is important. It absolutely is horrible. And these tales about the poisoning of the well and the rude disposition of some of the people in the immigrant train, simply, even if they were true, they still don't justify any action at all, let alone the massacre that came about.
Absolutely. I think there's another few instances in there that this book really fights against the idea of inevitability, that the massacre was going to happen no matter who stepped in or made different decisions, that the massacre was a result of decisions of a host of decisions made at various points. So that's really caught up in how the book is structured. The book is structured around narrative, and it gives it emphasizes how one step leads to another, and at every step they could have taken another direction and yet they didn't. Very briefly, well, for the event itself, they argued that tragedy started when there's a conflict between the immigrant train and some Mormons that some of the immigrants were shot by Mormons who were out on their own. The Mormons thought that they could pass it off onto the Native Americans. There were still more skirmishes. The immigrants had formed a circle, isolating themselves, fearing that they were under attack. During a series of skirmishes over the next few days, this all takes over a week. And that's actually one thing that was new to me when I first read it back in 2008, that this wasn't a momentary thing that happened, that this was long and drawn out, and there were several different phases. And one of the big turning points was in one of the skirmishes, the Fancher train realized that the people that were raiding them were not Native Americans, but that they were white Mormons. And so now the Mormon leaders in southern Utah were afraid about if we let them go, they're going to go out and get and tell the army, and now we're going to get the Californians on us, and the federal government is going to go on. So what are we going to do? And one of the central parts of this narrative is the importance of councils and council decisions. So it sounds like a very Mormon thing to do, but it's in a case it is. Walker, Turley, and Leonard argued that at every point that when there is supposed to be a council decision, that the men who are gathering in priesthood councils or city councils or militia councils, things start dying down. As in things, cooler heads are prevailing, and they realize we should send a messenger to Brigham Young to see what he finds out. We should take a day off and kind of think about what we're doing. But every time that the council seem to make things slow down, there is always a hothead that starts working behind the scenes or isn't fully transparent about what's happening. And especially John D. Lee, and most especially Isaac Hale, seem so hell-bent on punishing the immigrants who they felt were at fault, which wasn't true, but they felt that way, and B, that a lot of horrible things are going to happen if the immigrants go, that they work around the councils, they ignore the council decisions, and that leads them to leading the immigrants into being slaughtered under the flag of truce on September 11th.
Yeah, and that, not the final chapter. The final chapter is about John D. Lee's execution. Read the last two chapters, 13 and 14, are just horrible to read. You're reading a massacre. You're subjecting yourself to things that you do not think of when you think about pioneers and you think about settlers. It's horrible and it's depressing to read. And then in the epilogue is a brief review of the execution of John D. Lee, the ritual execution of John D. Lee.
I'll add that I remember I read this book. I was still an undergrad at BYU, and I was interning up in Salt Lake City, so I was taking the express bus up in the morning. The bus left at like 6:30 a.m. and I was reading this book on the bus going up to Salt Lake. And I remember one morning, about a week after the book release, I had made it to the part in the book where it's talking about the massacre, and it's dawn. I still remember the misty air. I still remember the smell of gasoline in the bus and the smell of BO of my fellow passengers, and just starting to tear up because of just how powerful and tragic those events are, and they're told quite movingly, and it's really a shock to your humanity that people are able to do such atrocity. It's quite a sobering thing to do, to read this account.
Yeah, it's a horrible tale, and they go through great detail in sequence of all the things that happened until it was complete and the last person that was going to be killed was killed. So what happened when church-employed historians published this book? What was the reaction?
Well, of course it should be clearly said that this book is always going to be framed as an institutional history. Whenever you see people write about Massacre at Mountain Meadows, they say a book written by three church historians. And that's true. And that's always going to frame it for good or ill. I mean, the good of that is that the church needs to tell the story. The ill is, you know, non-Mormons are never going to fully accept it. And that's just a fact, and we're going to have to deal with it. But besides that, it received a very positive reaction. It sold out. The first few printings sold out within weeks. It went through many printings over the next few months. It sold something like 44,000 copies in the first 2 months. Oxford University Press, who is a publisher, the editor once told me that Massacre at Mountain Meadows was what kept the press out of the red that year. And in the end, it's what made Oxford more dedicated to publishing Mormon studies work. The academics mostly embraced it. I mean, there's always a cautious that these are church historians, how much we can trust it, but it received very favorable reviews in the Journal of American History, in Reviews in American History, in American Historical Review, and those are the three biggest and most respected academic journals, and all of them gave positive reviews to the book. In my chatting with other historians of American history, American West, and American religious history, most accept it as the standard work for the massacre. The downside is it's only one half of the tale. We still need to get the cover-up. And Rick Turley is currently at work. Who knows when that's going to be finished, but until that's finished, this is only half the story, and we'll have to rely on Will Bagley's Blood of the Prophets to fill in the rest of the tale. Besides the academic world, it seeped into church curriculum. They wrote an essay that made it in the Ensign that told a pretty good account of the massacre and its main lessons. It's part of the Institute manual now. It worked its way into one of the church topic essays that came up in the last few years. And it's also seeped into our discourse of how we talk about the past. One of my favorite moments from the last few years was hearing Elder Marlon Jensen, who was formerly the church historian, now is an emeritus general authority, talking to a group of saints and talking about the Mountain Meadows Massacre. And he said that the main lesson he learned from the book that all Latter-day Saints should know is that there is nothing virtuous about blind obedience. And I think that's a lesson that all Mormons should learn. And if that's a lesson we learn from this book, then I think it's quite crucial to us as a people.
Absolutely. For me, I think that this event, as grisly and gruesome as it is, this needs to be into not just the Institute curriculum, but in the Sunday school curriculum. I doubt that it will be, because the lessons are sometimes quite challenging to some of the things we hear in General Conference, where we hear a lot about obedience. But as a group, as a religious people, we have this opportunity to remind ourselves of real events that are similar to what are observed through the Stanford Prison Experiment and the Milgram Experiment. And I think it would make us a better people to be aware of those, and to be more aware of the effects of authority, and to be cautious in running to action. I think that we are so assimilated now, I highly doubt that any massacres are going to occur anytime soon, but we can still learn from this event and become and be edified.
Absolutely. And one more parting thing for those who are interested in reading more. You have to read the Juanita Brooks book. You have to read Will Bagley. You have to read Massacre at Mountain Meadows. There's also great documentary sources out. Will Bagley co-edited a volume in his Kingdom of the West series called Innocent Blood that has the essential documents of the Meadows Massacre. And as I mentioned before, Walker, Turley, and Leonard, or at least two of the three, edited a volume for BYU Studies that have the Andrew Jensen interviews, and also forthcoming Janice Johnson, who's a brilliant historian and helped with this book, has edited the John D. Lee trial papers and his prosecution papers, and that's forthcoming from the University of Oklahoma Press, and that's going to be a really helpful and a really important addition to the field.
Yeah, I think that's good stuff because, as I said, this is an important event, and to understand it better will help us to be better, I think, or at least it has the potential to do so.
Right.
Well, thanks, Ben, for discussing this really, in my mind, a sensitive and tricky topic that needs to be discussed with us on the podcast today.
Well, I'm happy to do it.
Next month, next time around, let's see, we're going to do the Mormon question, right?
Looking forward to it.
Well, folks, that is the interview with Ben Park, and I hope that you enjoyed it. I hope that Ben provided some insight and background to the event, and especially to the book, Massacre at Mountain Meadows, that may incite you to read it, or if you already have read it, to perhaps reconsider or rethink some of the ways you've thought about it in the past, because I think that is always good. As I mentioned earlier at the beginning of the podcast, I have a few things that I would like to share. You might have noticed in the podcast I wasn't as comfortable as I am in other interviews or discussions that I've been involved in, and it's because this is just a really difficult topic to discuss because it's so atrocious. And there's just a few things that I think are worth considering, and one thing is a perspective from a non-LDS historian, John G. Turner, the author of Brigham Young, Pioneer Prophet. He has about a chapter or so devoted to this era, and I thought I would read some bits of that book. Pages I'm looking at are pages, information from pages 279 to 280. Now, as I remember, I did not share this bit in the interview. If I did and my memory is failing me, which it very well could be, I apologize. But as Turner's discussing this, he talks about the scholarship that's already been published and some of the views that are out there. At the bottom of page 279, he writes, Bagley concludes that Young sent George A. Smith to southern Utah in August 1857 to set in motion the destruction of the Fancher-Baker train. More recently, three historians employed by the Church History Department depicted the massacre as the work of local church leaders. Past persecution and wartime fervor overcame moral scruples and led Mormons in southern Utah to dehumanize and destroy their Gentile enemies. An interesting point about placing the blame, where one might read that statement as Bagley trying to place the blame squarely on the shoulders of Brigham Young, and the historians commissioned by the church are doing everything they possibly can to get the blame away from Brigham Young. A little bit of insight or thinking on the part of Turner. In the next paragraph on page 280, he continues saying, There is no satisfactory evidence that Young ordered the massacre. The most straightforward reading of Young's letter to Haight is exculpatory. Given his political objective of keeping the army away from Mormon settlements, moreover, there was no good reason for Young to order a massacre with the potential to focus the full fury of the American government on Utah. I think that's a very important insight to realize, that as rash, as bold, as violent, as vulgar as Brigham Young likely was, he was also very practical, and it would not seem like a strategic move to incite violence against immigrant trains who are simply passing through the territory. So there is that bit of reading that I've done that I wanted to share for those who haven't read Massacre at Mountain Meadows, Blood of the Prophets, or Brigham Young Pioneer Prophet. I just think those are important bits of information and thinking to be aware of. If you look at the show notes for this podcast episode, you'll see that I've put a bunch of links to things that are not really Mormon. The things that I have linked to are a TED Talk by Philip Zimbardo, a YouTube video describing the Milgram experiments, a podcast episode from the podcast called Very Bad Wizards, which is a podcast featuring discussions between a philosopher and a social psychologist discussing in a informal way ethics, morality, and science in general. And a link to another podcast of The Hardcore History by Dan Carlin, the episode titled Prophets of Doom. All of these links or resources discuss the psychology or history of evil and violence. And I've found that understanding these events or empirical discoveries really help frame the Mountain Meadows Massacre. It helps me understand how people can turn and how people can change and how they can justify horrible actions or can get caught up in something as awful as the massacre. I will warn, the Very Bad Wizards episode, they use a lot of profanity, and I think the first 10 to 15 minutes it's a podcast of a psychologist and a philosopher discussing things as if they were in a bar. And so the first 10 or 15 minutes is just kind of them doing their thing, joking around. But then they do go through talking about the Milgram experiment and the Stanford Prison experiment, which I have the YouTube link to a short video describing the Milgram experiment and the TED Talk of Philip Zimbardo, who was the researcher that designed and carried out the Stanford Prison experiment. And I just bring this information because these experiments, they would never be able to be carried out today because we have a completely different ethical standard in science. Because of these experiments. And so we are blessed, or we are lucky, that we had Milgram and we had Zimbardo that carried out these experiments, because I think they tell us quite a bit about human behavior and how situations really change who we are. They shift us into different ways of thinking, and they the things that we wear, the authority or hierarchical structure that we're operating in, can really change the way that we approach interacting with other people. And so I just want to make you aware of and leave these resources, because I think they give us a good framing for this event in Mormon history. And the last one, the Prophets of Doom episode from Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. It's a really long episode. It's like 4 hours long, but it's definitely worth listening to. It is a journalistic style presentation of an episode in history during the Protestant Reformation. A separate group of Anabaptists, an extremist group of Anabaptists, set off an event called now referred to as the Munster Rebellion in Munster, Germany. And in the end, these prophets, or so-called prophets, committed extreme acts of violence, extreme degrees of social control, and imposed deprivation of all sorts on the people, separated themselves from the outside world, and instituted polygamy on top of that. It's an interesting bit of history, especially as a Mormon who has to deal with our own faith community's history of violence and polygamy. It makes us maybe feel not so alone and realize again in the context of situationalism and fanaticism what kinds of awful things can happen. So I will leave that with you. And for next week on the podcast, you can look forward to an interview with Jedediah S. Rogers, who is the author of The Council of 50, a documentary history. So look forward to that, and until next time, as always, keep keeping it weird. ¶¶